This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The hidden perils of student debt forgiveness. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
When student debt is forgiven, graduates are able to breathe a financial sigh of relief, but only until the IRS comes knocking.
On the tech front, Spotify has a new rival. We'll have a review of YouTube Music.
A Florida mom makes a sentimental post about the relevance of kids' shoes on her front porch, and the internet cried.
And how restaurants are trying to wow us with wildly unique drinks this summer.
Pickle juice, watermelon drink with seeds. Those are two of the most outlandish drinks of the year, and more crazy drinks could be coming in the future. Experts say that people are looking for drinks that they could put on Instagram and social media. They just want that shareable drink.
Kelly Tyko at TC Palm and the USA Today Network on the summer's coolest and wackiest drinks. She's here later in the hour. Students seeking relief on their college and graduate school debt could be sitting on a hidden tax bomb. Billions of dollars in one-time bills from the IRS for any debt that they get forgiven. The tax bills are a feature of the income-driven repayment plans that have been offered by the Education Department since 2007. More on what's unfolding from Wall Street Journal reporter Josh Mitchell. Josh, set the scene.
So we have what's called income-driven repayment plans, and basically this is if you have student debt and you want to cut how much you spend each month on your student loan payments, you can set them at 10% of your discretionary income. There's a formula that will come up with the, you know, just how much you pay. And then what happens is you pay for about 20 or 25 years, depending on when exactly you took out your student loans and how much debt you owe. And then after that, your debt will be forgiven under these plans. But the problem is that any amount that is expunged is taxed as income. And so what's happening is you pay just a little bit each month for the next 20 years, but then you'll have this huge bill at the end of the plan. So I think what's happening is a lot of people are enrolling in these plans, and it's good for now. Mm. But down the road, they'll face a pretty big bill from the IRS.
Wow. What's the average tax bill? Anybody begin to calculate that for an individual?
No, it's really hard to know because, you know, this law, the plans only really came into effect in 2007 or so. So we won't really know until 2027. But I can tell you that the Obama administration estimated, you know, the average person would have about $41,000 forgiven at the end of this. So if you think about that, if you're 25% tax bracket, that's about $10,000. And there's going to be some people with a lot more than that, you know. Some people could face tens of thousands of dollars in a tax bill or hundreds of thousands. So this could be a problem down the road.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Josh Mitchell. He's written a fascinating story entitled Student Debt Forgiveness is a Wonderful Boon Until the IRS Comes Calling. We're talking about a couple hundred billion dollars in total here of the amount of debt that's owed or could be required to be
paid
back.
Right. So as of right now, there's more than $300 billion enrolled in income-driven repayment. So that's just the amount of money that's in these plans. Now, keep in mind, some people will pay off their debt before it reaches the 20-year mark, and therefore they will not face a tax bill. And I should also clarify that if you're, you know, in this program called Public Service Loan Forgiveness, there is no tax if you're in that plan. But if you're a private sector worker, you know, yeah, I mean, there's $300 billion of this. One estimate was that about $108 billion just in principal will be forgiven just for all of the loans that were issued through the past year. So that doesn't include prospective loans, but we're talking about a lot of cash here. And but here's the thing that I should point out. You know, if people don't have the money, the IRS might not be able to, might be forced to cut you a deal, or just might not be able to come after you. If you can show that you actually don't have the wealth to pay off these bills, you know, the IRS might just be forced to write off that debt. So it's really a big problem, because some people will be forced to pay, you know, even if they have the cash saved up, they, you know, might have to pay a lot. But then you have this issue of, if the IRS forgives some of this debt, you know, some people might get a bigger subsidy than others, and there's a fairness issue here.
Anybody from another planet, Josh, would look at this and go, this is insane. So you can't afford to pay for college, so you borrow. Then you can't really afford to pay it back, so you postpone it and just pay a little bit. And then you can't afford to pay what you owe from the government, and that all might go away too.
Yeah, right? You know, I was talking with someone, one of the higher education trade groups. I was talking with someone who is the head of this trade group, and he was around when they passed this law. And you know, he said that people did not pay attention to this idea that the forgiven amount would be taxed. It was just kind of something. It was an oversight. And so I think what's happening now is, as we get closer to people, you know, reaching the 20-year mark, we aren't there yet. But you know, as things get closer to that point, people are starting to realize this is going to be a big problem.
Thanks, Josh. Wall Street Journal reporter Josh Mitchell, who's based in Washington. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Final weekend of June. Switching surnames can be a dicey proposition for politicians who risk suspicions that they're more about style than substance. But recent high-profile examples show that losing an unwieldy name or gaining one with more ethnic flair may be a gamble worth taking. More from Valerie Richardson, national reporter at USA Today. Valerie, what have you found?
I think what's interesting is some really big political names out there actually were not born with the names we know them by today, and Bill de Blasio is the one that I think instantly comes to mind. He was born Warren Wilhelm Jr., which doesn't seem to have any connection to the name Bill de Blasio, so that's one that you know, always turns heads. But I don't think really outside of New York City that many people were aware of that. In New York City, it's people kind of are aware of it because it's come up during different campaigns. But yeah, I think what's interesting too is a lot of these politicians have names that are pretty different, and yet people aren't really aware of it.
Wow. So how does the New York City mayor explain his transition from Warren Wilhelm to Bill de Blasio?
Yeah, well, what happened is that he's actually changed his name legally twice since he was born. After being born Warren Wilhelm Jr., what he has said is that he went by Bill, which I guess is kind of short for Wilhelm. And then when he became like college age, early 20s, he hyphenated his name to use his mother's maiden name. His mother's maiden name was de Blasio. And at that point, he was Warren de Blasio Wilhelm. But then in 2000, before he ran for mayor, he changed it to he just dropped Warren Wilhelm altogether and just changed it legally to Bill de Blasio. And yeah, so that's the name he's obviously known by in politics. So you can see the trend, you know, you can see the progression there. But yeah, it's definitely not intuitive. I mean, most politicians who change their names, it's like a little more subtle. For example, Kevin DeLeon this year is running against Dianne Feinstein in California in the Senate race. They're both Democrats, but they have a top two primary there. She got the first slot, he got the second. He's the former Senate president in California. Well, his birth name is actually Kevin Leon, but he changed it, he says, during his college days to Kevin DeLeon, adding the D and then, you know, adding an accent over the O in Leon so that it would kind of, you know, frankly have a more Hispanic flavor. And people have accused him basically of saying, you know, you changed your name to sound more Hispanic to appeal to voters. You know, obviously in California, the Latino vote is huge. Mm-hmm. And the way he explains it, though, is he said, well, I never really knew my father. I only met him once, you know, and I wanted to sort of, you know, feel more connected to him. Well, the reason some people sort of, you know, don't necessarily buy that explanation is because while both his parents are Guatemalan, his dad's last name was Leon. It wasn't De Leon, and yet he says he changed it to De Leon to feel more closer to his father, so I don't quite understand that.
Wow. I'm speaking with Valerie Richardson, Washington Times national reporter based in Denver. She's written a piece about politicians who have changed their names. Which other ones jumped out at you?
Well, there's in Colorado, there's Jared Polis. He is a congressman from Colorado, from the Boulder area, has been a congressman for a long time, about five terms. But when he first moved to Colorado after graduating from Princeton, he switched his last name and his middle name, which is actually more, among politicians who do change their name, that's pretty common. They'll take their mother's maiden name. He was Jared Schutz when he was at Princeton. He moved to Colorado. He was about to launch his first campaign for the State Board of Education, and he dropped Schutz and took Polis. And he later said that, you know, he was pretty frank about it. He said, "I wanted to honor my mother, but I also just like the name better." And, you know, who can blame him? A Schutz isn't necessarily the most, you know, mellifluous name in the world. It rhymes with putz and klutz. You can see it becoming a source of mockery. Yeah. So, you know, I sort of get that. You have in Texas, Congressman Ruben Gallego. He did the same thing in terms of switching his mother's maiden name for his, you know, his father's name. He used to be Ruben Marine Lorena. He obviously wasn't doing it to sound more Hispanic. Both names were Hispanic, but Marine Lorena, it's a long name. It's kind of a mouthful, and you can see how Gallego would be a little catchier.
Wow.
In that case, and you know, one thing I also looked at in this story was a couple of politicians who did not change their names, even though their names are pretty tough. One of which is a Massachusetts state senator named Ryan Fatman, F-A-T-T-M-A-N, and it's, you know, for the record, he's actually not overweight, but he said, you know, he actually likes his name because it's such an icebreaker with voters. They're like, "Is that really your name?" And he's able to make jokes about it. It makes him very memorable. So he sort of likes having sort of an unflattering name, if you will.
Well, that would be tough, though, if he were overweight, right? With a last name Fatman or Fatman. Jeez. Thanks, Valerie. Valerie Richardson, national reporter at USA Today. 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 most improved state for business, Michigan. Contact michiganbusiness.org today. YouTube Music, which had a soft launch last month, is now available nationally and in 17 countries. This is the latest attempt by the video network owned by Google to take on Spotify and Apple Music with a premium service based on the huge music library of YouTube. Jefferson Graham at USA Today has been experimenting with it. Jeff, give us the basics.
The basic gist is that YouTube has more music than any of the other services because beyond the hits and the library albums, they also have TV appearances, they have international dates, they have live concerts. There's just so much more there. And so YouTube has this new music service. They've been talking about it for years. It finally launched, and it's available to all. It's $10 a month, and it's basically the same as Spotify and Apple Music, unlimited music. Their pitch is that Google knows more about you based on your searches and your email and planning your trips. And so if you're planning a trip to Chicago, they're going to play you songs about Chicago.
Oh, wow.
So they can come up with songs because they know all this stuff. That's the sales proposition. The truth is, it's just the same. Their music selection by a computer is no better than what Spotify gives you or what Apple gives you.
Okay,
that's the sad truth.
And it's going to replace Google Play Music?
It's going to replace Google Play Music, but they won't say when. Google Play Music could be around for quite some time. For right now, if you're a Google Play Music subscriber, you will get both.
We're speaking with Jefferson Graham, USA Today technology columnist. He also hosts a podcast called Talking Tech, and he's written a piece about the new YouTube Music. Likes and dislikes here. What do you think?
It's a good first stab. They've got one feature which is called an endless mixtape, where it's similar to what Spotify does every Monday with Discover Weekly, and it will just play songs that it thinks you like. And you can keep refreshing the page and get a new playlist. That's kind of fun. The only problem is that their computer model puts a lot of the same artists into your playlist. So I'm a fan of Pat Metheny, the guitar player.
Yeah.
So in one playlist, five songs out of 25 were by Pat Metheny, which is not right for a playlist. It's not supposed to be like that.
Right.
And then another one gave me five songs by Chaka Khan, the R&B singer, and three by Al Green. Two of them were Christmas songs in June.
Okay.
And I didn't want to hear them. I don't think you do either, Gordon. But one thing you can do, which is kind of fun, is you can type in Pat Metheny and just get nonstop Pat Metheny music,
which
is good. And or you could pick a song. You can pick a song all about that bass, and you can put it on, and then you'll hear that song, and then other artists of that ilk. Meghan Trainor was the singer of that. Then you'll start hearing Katy Perry and Lady Gaga and people like that. So they do that very well. For the biggest problem with the unlimited music services is that we don't know what to listen to.
Yeah,
we're stumped.
Yeah.
And we just listen to the same old stuff. So anything they can do to come up with suggestions and to be, basically be your DJ is great. I will just say that Spotify does it better.
Okay.
Spotify has... Their Discover Weekly and their instant playlists are a better representative of what I like to listen to, which is surprising because I've been a Google Play subscriber for quite some time, and I'm a huge fan of YouTube. I find that YouTube's recommendation algorithm always gets it right. I don't know why YouTube Music hasn't gotten it right yet.
Nice, Jeff. Jefferson Graham, USA Today technology reporter. It's 30 minutes now. After the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org. Thanks for joining us. Welcome aboard, Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, why more of us have a side hustle these days. Also, how restaurants are competing to deliver the summer's coolest and wackiest drinks. And the mom whose sentimental post has gone viral about shoes on her front porch. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, people who squirrel away cash, like burying it in a backyard, are not altogether irrational. In fact, one financial advisor argues that as long as they don't forget about it, these folks are actually making the right decision with their money. Adam Grossman, advisor with Mayport in Boston, wrote a piece on HumbleDollar.com that says the reality is that many, if not most, of our financial decisions are driven by emotional goals and not by any kind of logical or numerical cost-benefit analysis. Adam, explain.
The theme of the article is that most money decisions we make are only partially based in logic, and that really they're mostly driven by emotion. Now, that sounds like a bad thing, but what I argue in this article is that that's actually okay.
So what about the folks who are like, you know, serious savers? Because you mentioned this one guy found like, you know, 150 grand in his backyard, you know, that had been left by a previous owner. But make that connection, I guess.
Right. So the fellow that you reference, he lives in the rural Midwest, and he was digging in his yard one day, and he found $150,000. It had been left behind. And this article caught my eye because I used to work at an investment firm and had a colleague who actually spent a day with a client digging up his grandparents' backyard to find money that grandpa had said had been left behind. And it turns out that these stories are not that infrequent. They happen more during the Depression than they do today. But you know, I realize that while they sound humorous, the reality is that people stash money in all kinds of places. I've seen it in file cabinets. I've seen it in walls, in floor safes. And while it seems a little silly, and you might kind of smirk at somebody doing that, the fact is that we all make money decisions that are driven really by a fundamental desire to sleep at night and to feel security. And if that's what gives people security, then I feel like there's really nothing wrong with it, and it's really not irrational. It's actually perfectly rational.
Whether or not you're a freewheeling spender or you save every penny, you mean?
Well, exactly. And I think that, you know, there's really only one caveat to what I was saying, which is that the title of the article is Happily Misbehaving. And it's it's fine to, quote-unquote, misbehave a little bit with your money as long as you're doing the basics. So if you're saving sufficiently for retirement and saving sufficiently for other key needs and you're able to pay your bills, then who's to say that it's irrational for you, say, to buy an expensive car? Or if you want to take an equivalent sum and keep it in your checking account because you like seeing a big balance on the ATM slip and that just makes you feel good.
Yeah.
Or if you want to bury it in the backyard. To me, those are all equivalent decisions, and no one can say that any is more, quote-unquote, right than the other.
Interesting. We're speaking with Adam Grossman, contributor to HumbleDollar.com. He's also a financial advisor with Mayport in Boston, and he's written a piece entitled Happily Misbehaving, and he talks about the emotional connection to decisions we make about money. All right, so you mentioned as long as you're kind of being efficient with your money. I would guess that the problem is there's not a very big percentage of us who are.
Well, I think that's right. It's certainly the national statistics on retirement savings don't paint a very rosy picture. And so I think that if there's one thing that people ought to do, it's to do some basic projections for retirement and to think about how they will fund retirement, what will they need, and then to work backwards, figure out how much Social Security or a pension might contribute, and then to work backward from that and to figure out how much they need to save to fill in the difference. So certainly people need to do that, and all I'm saying is that once you're doing the basics, you know, the equivalent of a child eating his vegetables, well, it's okay then to have some ice cream afterward as long as you're meeting the basic needs.
Thanks, Adam. Adam Grossman, contributor to HumbleDollar.com. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you could spend some time with us. Do you work a part-time job? A new survey from Bankrate.com finds more than a third of all Americans has a side hustle, including more than half of millennials. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Who's got a side job these days? Men, millennials, and Republicans. Amanda Dixon of Bankrate joins us now to talk about the latest findings on side hustles. Amanda, what kinds of numbers are we talking about? Who has side jobs?
Well, what we found is that nearly four in 10 Americans say that they have a side hustle. And just like you said, millennials are more likely than any other age group to say that they earn extra money on the side. So are men, and so are Republicans. So, you know, quite a few people have second jobs.
Do we have any idea if this is an increase from years past? Are we getting more side jobs than we used to?
That's a great question. It's hard on this data because we have done this study in the past, but we've changed our methodology, and we use a different polling company this time around. So I'm not able to compare it to last year's results, but it does seem as though quite a few people, you know, more than you would expect, have second jobs.
Okay, Amanda, what kind of money are we talking about, perhaps per week or per month?
So what we found is that the average side is about $686 per month. And among those who side hustle at least once a month, they earn even more, you know, more than $800 per month on average. So people can earn quite a bit of money from earning money on the side.
Amanda, what kinds of stuff are we doing?
So the most popular side jobs today are home repair and landscaping, online sales, crafts, and also childcare-related jobs.
Now, I know your study at Bankrate looked at differences between what men and women were making. What did you find there?
Yes, what we found is that the amount that men say they side hustles is nearly three times more than what women say that they earn. So our data shows that men are slightly more likely to side hustle every week compared to women, so that might play into it.
And perhaps the kinds of jobs they're getting?
Right. So men say that they have a side job related to home repair or landscaping, while women are more likely to say that they babysit or they do something related to online sales. So those differences could play into why there are differences in earnings.
We're speaking with Amanda Dixon of Bankrate. Any reason for the Republican finding, or is that just a, you know, a quirky thing that came up?
Right, that's interesting. What we've noticed is that while wealthy individuals tend to gravitate toward the GOP, the party has been increasingly appealing to people who are struggling with their personal finances, and so I think that could explain why Republicans are currently in control of both houses and of Congress, and I guess we'll see what happens when midterms roll around.
Why do people say they need side jobs?
Great question. So what we found is that most people, nearly 60, say that they have side jobs because they just like having extra money on the side. And about 38% of people who have a side job are using that money to pay for daily living expenses. So it's a way to supplement their income.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Amanda Dixon at Bankrate.com. It's 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. If you like unique and refreshing drinks, this appears to be the summer of the outlandish. The concoctions are getting crazier. And although many restaurants make summer menu additions, this year there appears to be an increase in the wackiness as people look to share more, of course, on social media. It's a story by reporter Kelly Tycho with TC Palm and the USA Today Network. Kelly, what's available?
Pickle juice, watermelon drink with seeds. Those are the two of the most outlandish drinks of the year, and more crazy drinks could be coming in the future. Experts say that people are looking for drinks that they could put on Instagram and social media. They just want the shareable drink.
Wow.
That look good for to the friends.
You know, I'm gonna make this comparison to like women's shoes. Like, it doesn't matter what they taste like, perhaps, or with shoes what they feel like, as long as they look good. Is that what's happening here with these drinks?
That's what the expert I spoke to said, that the taste might not be a home run, but it's that factor of how crazy can it go. And he mentioned to me that maybe radish, you know, would be a radish drink in the future.
Come
I'm not
on.
Sure I'd want to try that one.
Jeez. Who's doing this, by the way? These restaurants or bars?
Yeah,
who's coming up with it?
Fast food restaurants for the most part. Sonic is who has the pickle-flavored slushy. I haven't tried it yet. I'm looking at it, but not so quite so sure if I want to yet. I'm going to venture there. And Taco Bell has the watermelon one with the seeds. Now, there is a choking hazard, especially for kids under 4. They have a big disclaimer about those seeds. And I've been told that even for adults, when you drink it too fast, you have to watch out for those seeds.
No kidding. That's crazy. What is this summer particularly unique in that some of these restaurants wanted to come up with this, or what's happening here?
Well, there's been the Starbucks has had drinks like the unicorn frappuccino, the crystal ball, and those people go pretty crazy for those drinks, and they sell out. You know, that whole that wacky factor, the limited item. But this year, it looks like they're going a little further. That, you know, especially the pickle juice. That's the craziest one so far. But you know, there's drinks with candy involved. So the sweet and sour. That's at Auntie Annie's that has a drink like that. Wawa has one with Jolly Ranchers. There's just a lot of sugary drinks out there.
I must say, I think that if I had to make a choice based on your list, Burger King with the salted caramel shake, that might be the one I fork over the money for.
Right. And, I mean, Starbucks, they've been, seems like they're trying to play it a little safer and adding more items to their permanent menu, such as the Serious Strawberry Frappuccino and the Mango Dragon Fruit Refresher. Those are two permanent menu items. But they also have two new cold foam tea lemonades available for a limited time. So they're playing it a little, seems to be playing a little safe. There's no, you know, crystal ball or unicorn frappuccino at this point.
That's Kelly. Kelly Tycho with TC Palm and the USA Today Network. Reminder, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter with the username at This Morning Show. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well with the username at Gordon Deal. 6 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Weekend, thanks for joining us. We all know how summer goes by pretty fast, right? But for one Florida mom, the last 18 summers have gone by in the blink of an eye. Heather Duckworth of Tampa recently had a post go viral on Facebook. It was a picture of 15 different pairs of shoes on her front porch. She reminisced on how these shoes signified that her twin sons were having friends over, the same group they've had over for 18 years. But now that group is going off to college, and Ms. Duckworth is looking to make the most of every moment she can with them. She said she'll cherish those shoes, even if that means her house probably doesn't have any food left or her house is loud with laughter and music and is overall just chaotic. The post has been embraced by other Facebook users and currently has over 78,000 likes, 12,000 comments. many of them from other parents, echoing her sadness, as those shoes will be running off to explore the world, as she says. While Ms. Duckworth is upset that the shoes probably won't make it back to her house next summer, she says she's excited to see what the new adventures they take. But for now, she spends her 18th and perhaps final summer with her twin boys. For Jennifer Koschenka and contributing writer Max Chadwick, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.